I mean, there is no explanation. And this notion that we wanted to investigate beforehand is absurd, because General Jones also provided documentation that even before this incident happened, you're supposed to tell the family right away if you suspect fratricide, period. It's not nebulous, as Colonel Nixon said. It's not nebulous at all. Then you can give the family your conclusions. So the idea that they were trying to protect us by not telling us until the investigation took place is ridiculous.
Representative Danny Davis.
Let me ask the Tillmans. On May 3rd, 2004, a large memorial service was held for Corporal Tillman in San Jose, California, which was carried on national television. And I'd like to ask both of you about that memorial service. I'm sure that Corporal Tillman's death was a severe blow to your entire family. This memorial was an opportunity to honor his service, to honor the fact that he gave his life for his country. And I imagine that you both were dealing with very difficult feelings and that you were trying to get some sense of closure. At the time of the service, you still thought that Pat Tillman had been killed in a firefight with the enemy. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So you had begun to come to terms with that at the memorial, and there were various Defense Department officials present, and they spoke about Corporal Tillman's bravery and his actions in fighting the enemy. Is that also correct?
Yes, sir.
Now I understand it that General Kissinger was the highest-ranking military officer who attended the service. Did you see General Kissinger at the memorial service?
Yes, I did.
Did you speak with him? And if so, what did he say?
I did speak with him. I don't remember what I said to him. I just remember feeling very comforted that he was there. He was very kind and warm and, you know.
But at this point, General Kissinger already knew that Pat's death was a friendly fire incident.
Yeah.
The memorial service was on May 3rd, and General Kissinger had received the P-4 memo on April 29th, 4 days earlier, warning that this was a friendly fire incident. But he didn't tell you anything about this. He didn't correct what was said at the ceremony. We had wanted to ask the general about his actions at our hearing today, but he has refused to testify. Last week, his attorney sent a letter to the committee invoking his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Mr. Chairman, I ask that this letter be made a part of the record.
Without objection, that'll be the order.
That was Danny Davis of Illinois. Here's Chairman Henry Waxman.
I can certainly see why you're outraged. You told misinformation. The country was told misinformation. There have been 5 investigations, and there are still unanswered questions. There are 3 internal investigations by the military. Then the Office of Inspector General and the CID did split it up and did 2 investigations themselves. And there are questions that we still haven't answered. How high up did this go? People knew early on that the story that was being sent around the world about your son was just not true. They didn't let you know for 4 or 5 weeks, but other people knew. And then those statements on the Silver Star Award, the Inspector General said those statements were fabricated, and yet he didn't tell us who fabricated them. Well, we're going to ask him about that in a minute. And then I've read, and no one's mentioned this, statements from people in the military who were so condescending to you to say, you're lost, you're grief, but you can't deal with this whole thing, you can't accept.
Well, basically, I would like to address that because
yeah.
Lieutenant, I believe he's the Lieutenant General. I lose track of he's a Colonel. He's still a Colonel. Colonel Kaslorich said, and I'm appalled that he would make these comments. He's entitled to his opinion, of course, but he said that we would never be satisfied because we're not Christians. spirituality doesn't enter into this, I guess, in his mind, but, you know, we're not Christians, so we can't put him to rest. And he then did, and that's why we will never be satisfied, and we're just a pain in the ass, basically. Then he did an interview on ESPN where he basically reiterated this, I mean, to a reporter, who then put it on a website and in an actual article. He also said that it must make us feel terrible that Pat's worm dirt. Well, I would like to address also General Abizaid, because General Abizaid was, you know, sent the memo, the P4, that almost everyone says is a very crucial memo, that it's supposed to be read right away, and he claims that he didn't receive it. He said he was in Iraq. Well, on the Pentagon website, there's an interview. He did a press conference on April 30th, and he was in Qatar. And in that press conference, he makes reference to the fact that he was in Afghanistan the day before talking to Pat's platoon leader, who was wounded in the same exchange that Pat was wounded in. Pat's platoon leader was shot in the face in the same exchange of fire. And at that time, the platoon leader really didn't know that he was killed by or wounded by friendly fire or fratricide. And so that's kind of the excuse, I guess, Abizaid has given or other people have given to indicate, oh, well, even though he was in Afghanistan, you know, Lieutenant Uthlat didn't know he was wounded by friendly fire, therefore he couldn't have told Abizaid. Well, I contend that almost every soldier in Afghanistan at that point knew Pat had been killed by fratricide. So the idea that they wouldn't tell, you know, Abizaid what was going on if he didn't already know is ridiculous. And Abizaid at the time was dealing with Iraq that was an absolute nightmare. The fact that he would go to Afghanistan to visit a lieutenant that's wounded is kind of suspicious. I mean, why would he do that? I'm sure Abizaid was not that concerned about Pat. I mean, he's got other things to worry about. But he would be concerned about Pat knowing he was killed by friendly fire or fratricide. I mean, that would make a huge difference. And that could explain why he was there. And I don't know if he talked to Uthlat on the phone or if he talked to him in person. But it doesn't really matter. The fact that Abizaid was in Afghanistan on that day indicates to me that he probably knew that Pat was killed by friendly fire. I just want to make that very clear.
Well, you know, what you're saying underscores the reason that you're all before us in this panel, because your cases illustrate the fact that stories were put out that were not true, they were put out deliberately, and that we still don't know how far up this went. We don't know what the Secretary of Defense knew. We don't know what the White House knew. These are questions the committee seeks answers to. What we do know is that this was not a series of accidents, these stories. They were calculatedly put out for a public relations purpose, and they lingered out there for a very long time, and even now there seems to be, as they say, a cover-up to try to prevent us from all knowing what actually happened in all of the circumstances.
You're listening to excerpts of the April 24th, 2007 U.S. Congress Oversight and Government Reform Committee hearing on the accuracy of battlefield information. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. Next is the testimony of Brian O'Neill, the soldier who was with Tillman when he was killed, and whose written witness statement of this event was subsequently altered by persons unknown.
I want to start with you, Specialist O'Neill, and I want to thank you for being here to testify about these events. I know they must be difficult for you to revisit. But we've asked you here for a number of reasons, one of which is to find out exactly what happened to Pat Tillman on April 22, 2004, 3 years ago this week. You were there. You were a firsthand witness. In fact, you were the last person to see Pat Tillman alive. Let me begin by asking you about the events leading up to the shooting. When the platoon split up, you were part of the front group referred to as Serial 1, which is the same group Corporal Tillman was with. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you had an Afghan soldier with you as well. Is that right?
The Afghan soldier, after the ambush, and Corporal Tillman and I dismounted our GMVs and started to assault the position, the enemy position, that's when I discovered the Afghan militiaman had dismounted with us, but he was not in our GMV that we were arriving in, sir. Okay.
You were positioned on a ridge overlooking the road on which the other half of the platoon, Serial 2, was traveling. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And can you describe why your team was positioned on that particular ridge?
Well, Pat and myself and the AMS soldier, when we dismounted and started moving towards position where we finally ended up being in, had direction, I believe, from the squad leader that was from a different squad who was also in the GMV I was riding in. It basically directed us to go along that side of the ridge, and they were covering the other side, and that's to my knowledge of why we were in that position. Myself being a private at the time, I was just following my team leader, and where he went, I went there and tried to go there faster, sir.
I'm sorry to have to ask you this, but I would like you to tell us, in your own words, what happened right before and after Corporal Tillman was killed. Walk us through this in as much detail as you can recall. What was Corporal Tillman doing at the time? Was he trying to signal that this might be friendly fire? Was he signaling with his arms? Was he yelling? What was he saying? Could you just tell us about it?
Yes, sir. When we moved into our final position, Pat and I and the Afghan militiamen had decided, or Pat decided, that we were going to continue to assault, and he wanted further guidance from the squad leader that was controlling our element. So he left myself and the AMF soldier, and when he returned, he basically let me know that we were going to continue moving in the route that we were. And before he was able to finish telling me what our plan was, we had started to receive fire from a GMV. At first, it was short, sporadic. I didn't really understand what was happening. I looked and saw that it was friendly fire coming towards us. Pat asked me basically what was going on, and I let him know. And it didn't take long before those in the GMV who were stopped at the time to dismount and open up on us with the 50 caliber machine gun and the 240 Bravo machine gun, and basically shot at us in waves or bursts of rounds. At that time, I felt myself become limp, and I got down. I had no cover, and there was nothing blocking my sight watching the people at the Humvee shooting at us. I know Pat had basically was able to get himself behind some cover, but it was not much. I basically was yelling, waving from on the ground as much as I could, and I believe Pat was too at the time because he was behind me, and talking to him, yelling, screaming, trying to figure out what was going on, when he told me he had a plan, and he, at the time, I thought, popped a pen gun flare, you know, to signal the troops down in the GMV that we were friendlies, but I later discovered he had popped a smoke grenade. And after he had done that, the firing ceased in the truck. So we had both believed at that time that the shooting was over and that they had recognized us as friendlies. And we both stood up, faced each other, was kind of wondering, hey, what just happened there? Wow, it was an accident, you know. Luckily, we're both still alive. It didn't take long after that, sir, before they moved into a better position, as I said, in the GMV, and started shooting at us again. And at that time, both of us had gotten down. I was watching them do that, and I could hear Pat calling, stop shooting, Pat, Ethan Tillman, stop shooting, you know, over and over and over again. And I could hear the pain that he had in his voice. So I had known that he was hurt at that time. And it abruptly stopped with him calling for help. And it wasn't too long after that before the truck had moved out. So I laid on my side for a while wondering what had just happened, because I was young and I didn't really understand. When I discovered there was a large pool of blood forming up around me.
Did you have any doubt at that time that it was friendly fire that killed Pat Tillman?
No, sir, I'm 100% positive that was friendly fire.
And who was the first person you informed that the attack may have been a friendly fire shooting?
The very first person I informed was right after I got up and checked on Pat and discovered he was dead. The guy, the squad leader I called for, came to my position, and I believe he knew, but when our medic came up to come assist us, he asked what happened, and I tried to let him know.
Who was he? Can you identify the name?
That would be Sergeant Anderson.
Sergeant Anderson.
And he basically asked me what happened. I tried to let him know, but our squad leader told me, basically, just don't say anything at that time. And later on that night, the first person I definitely told would be Specialist Pedro Areola. We were inside the little village where we were being, set up position in, and pulling security on the personnel that lived in that village. And he asked me point blank, "Do you know what happened?" And I informed him, "Yes, this was friendly fire, sir."
Did you inform First Sergeant Thomas Fuller?
Yes, I did, sir. I informed him later that night that it was friendly fire.
And how about Command Sergeant Alfred Birch?
Yes, sir. He knew at the time, sir.
And how about, you said Sergeant Ward, you did inform?
I do not believe I told Sergeant Ward. I was pretty incoherent at that time. I was going into shock, I believe.
How about Sergeant Jackson?
Sergeant Jackson, I definitely told that it was running fire, sir.
Okay. Now let me turn to the Inspector General. Mr. Gimbel, according to your report on April 23, Sergeant Fuller and Sergeant Birch told Captain William Saunders and Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Bailey that they suspected fratricide. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you also found that Colonel Bailey then told Colonel James Nixon, who in turn told Major General Stanley McChrystal, commander of the Joint Task Force. Is that right?
Right.
And you found that General McChrystal informed Brigadier General Howard Yellen, the deputy commander of the Army Special Operations Command, and all of these communications happened no later than April 25th. Is that right?
I believe that's correct.
Your report states that General Yellen then contacted Philip Kenzinger, a lieutenant general and the commander of the Army's Special Operations Command, and told him of the potential fratricide. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And Specialist O'Neill, let me return to you. As we've indicated here, you reported this incident as you should have, then went up the chain of command, and within 72 hours, at least 9 military officials knew or were informed that Pat Tillman's death was a fratricide, including at least 3 generals. Given that so many people in the military were informed so quickly that this was fratricide, does it trouble you that the Tillman family was kept in the dark about this for another month?
Yes, sir, it does. I wanted right off the bat to let the family know what had happened, especially Kevin, because I've worked with him in the platoon, and I knew that him and the family all needed to know what had happened. And I was quite appalled that when I was actually able to speak with Kevin, I was ordered not to tell him what happened, sir.
You were ordered not to tell them?
Roger that, sir.
By whom?
At that time, it was by our battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Bailey, sir.
And did he give you a reason or just an order?
He basically just said, sir, that do not let Kevin know. He's probably in a bad place knowing his brother's dead. And he made it known that I would get in trouble, sir, if I spoke with Kevin on it being fratricide, sir.
I'm going to Mr. Braley.
Thank you, Specialist O'Neill. Thank you for appearing today. In addition to being an eyewitness to Corporal Tillman's death and reporting this incident up the chain of command, you were also involved in writing a statement that was used to award Corporal Tillman the Silver Star. Do you remember that?
Yes, sir.
And now we are aware of serious questions that have been raised as to whether someone tampered with your statement. Let me start by asking you whether you remember the point in time where you were asked to write down your recollections of that day.
I can't say I remember the exact point in time where I was informed that I would be writing up a witness statement towards what happened. I just remember having my platoon sergeant at the time tell me that I was going to be writing up a statement on what happened for an award for Pat, sir.
But can you give us some general time frame and the sequence of events you've been discussing here today to give us some context into when that request was made by your platoon sergeant?
I would say a general time frame, probably the 26th or 27th of April. We didn't get back to Salerno for a few days after Pat was killed. So as soon as we got back to Salerno, that's when I was advised or asked to write the statement, sir.
And I've been involved in 23 years of being an attorney and having witnesses prepare statements. Was this a situation where they gave you a sheet of paper and told you to write down in your own words your best recollection of the events that had happened, or did someone prepare a statement for you to review and sign?
What happened, sir, was I got sat behind a computer and I was told to type up my recollection of what happened. And as soon as I was done typing, I was relieved to go back to my platoon, sir. And that was the last I heard of it.
So when you finished typing your statement, it was in a digital format that had not been printed out. Is that correct?
Roger that, sir.
And so no one printed it out and asked you to review it and verify it and sign it at the time it was originally drafted by you?
No, sir.
So at any time, did you ever sign in your handwriting a statement that you had reviewed and verified the authenticity of?
Negative, sir.
Now I want to ask you about the statement that was ultimately used in the Silver Star Commendation. This version of the statement says the following, quote, Corporal Tillman moved us into a position where we would be safe from enemy rounds. To the best of your recollection, did you write this sentence?
That sentence sounds like something I would have wrote, sir.
And where were the enemy rounds?
We weren't taking direct enemy rounds, sir, at that time. But we moved into a position where if we would have been, we would have been safe, sir.
Did Corporal Tillman shield you from enemy rounds at any time?
Negative, sir.
This version of the statement also says you, quote, engaged the enemy very successfully, end quote, that the enemy moved most of their attention to your position, which, quote, drew a lot of fire from them. Did you write these sentences claiming that you were engaged with the enemy?
No, sir.
Do you know who made the changes to your statement to make it appear as if you were receiving fire from the enemy rather than from your own platoon?
No, sir.
Mr. Gimble, the Inspector General's office investigated these alterations to the witness's statements and flagged these differences as well. But in the course of your investigation, did you ever discover who specifically changed this language and why that language was changed?
Let me just say this is the citations that we got were part of the package that we got out of the General Jones investigation, and they were not signed. It just had stamped as original signed, and our investigators went back to Specialist O'Neill and the sergeant and said, did you write these? And they said no, that they did not, okay, that there was parts of it that was accurate, parts of it were inaccurate. We were unable to determine who in the chain of command actually did the alterations of it, so we concluded that when people approved those statements or those citations based on those statements, being the battalion, regimental, and joint task force commanders, that they were accountable for the misstatements and inaccuracies.
Well, I have been through my father's service records from when he served on Iwo Jima, and there are signatures on almost every documentation of anything he did during the entire time he was enlisted. Is it your understanding that this practice of taking unsigned statements in support of a commendation recommendation is standard operating procedure within the Army?
I would not believe it is, but I would only point out that Silver Star, there actually does not have to be a valorous witness statements at the time this occurred. It can just be a citation.
Well, did you ever determine in the course of your investigation who, out of all the possible people who had contact with that statement, would have been the most likely person to have made alterations to the statement originally prepared by Specialist O'Neill?
Actually, no, we could not determine that. I could speculate, but I just prefer not to. It's somewhere in the approval chain that it got edited, and we really can't pin a face to the actual who did the keyboard changes on it. So that looked to sound the only action we had after that is that when you sign up on something, like when I sign something in my office, I'm assuming responsibility for it, the accuracy. and I hold myself accountable. So when you have the signatures on those citations and recommendations, they become accountable for it.
As part of your investigation, did you ever bring in an IT specialist to look at the hard drive on that computer or any other computer that that document had been placed upon to determine who had access to the computer and was responsible for the alteration?
We got this as a hard copy printout in the part of the investigative package from the General Jones investigation.
So did you ever determine the computers that it had been on and who had access?
No, we did not.
Do you think that would be a sensible follow-up part of an investigation looking into who might have been responsible for altering a document of this magnitude?
It would be a good thing, but the issue would be that it was 2 years before in theater, and we were I'm not sure we could ever track the computer down. It would be.
Well, we wouldn't know that unless we actually tried to track it down, would we?
We wouldn't.
Gimbel's excuse for not tracing the computer I find unconvincing. Gimbel claims this would be difficult because this was, quote, in theater. But O'Neill has just testified that he was in Salerno when he was told to type the statement. Salerno is a military base in Italy, not in the combat zone. A much different situation than in theater, which implies a temporary base in the battle zone.
Specialist O'Neill, I want to give you the opportunity to follow up on a response you were making in response to Mr. Waxman. And I think he had to cut you off to keep the hearing moving, but you were talking about after the shooting whether or not Corporal Tillman was dead immediately, and then you had to stop your narrative of that. Would you continue with your narrative of what you were saying at the time?
Yeah, it's not a problem, sir. I started off at that time I was on the ground, and I noticed blood pooling up around me, and at that time I had thought that I was shot. So I started communicating with Pat, not realizing he had passed away, asking him if he had been okay. And I had no response, and the blood was... There was a lot of blood everywhere, and I was starting to get really worried. So when I could finally get my body to move, I stood up and turned around and looked at Pat, and he was slumped back on the ground, covered in blood. And I went up to his position. I grabbed him and realized at that time that he had been shot in the head, and there wasn't much left of him. After that, I kind of blinked out. The next thing I remember was Sergeant Ward, who was part of 3rd Squad, telling me to pick up my helmet, and I didn't even remember taking it off, putting me on security, getting me to move out of the ridge line that we were in, and I just have little chunks of my memory will come back and then will go away, basically. That's the end of the night when I'm standing on the side of a building pulling security, and the regimental Sergeant Major Birch comes up to me and asks me if I'm all right. And after that, next thing I remember being inside a room pulling security on the local personnel and telling Specialist Ariel that Pat had been killed by friendly fire, sir.
Thank you.
Next is Representative Betty McCollum questioning Gimbel.
Can you tell me how high up this investigation went? I can't find in this report every single person that you spoke with. I mean, anybody in the Pentagon, Mr. Rumsfeld obviously referred to the Tillman case. How high up the chain of command did you go? Or should I ask, how high up the chain of command were you allowed to go?
We actually had a letter. We didn't interview the secretary, but we had a letter requesting information, which he provided on about the day he left the department, and it dealt specifically with the P4 issue. We interviewed General Abizade, General Brown, and all the generals that we've identified in the report as being accountable, and we interviewed over 100 people. So to the P4 message, if that was the question as to how high that went, according to what we have, is that it went to General Brown. He looked at it, and he was the commander of Special Operations Command, but he was not in the chain of command, so he acknowledged that he received it but did nothing with it. The General Kinsinger was the commander of the U.S. Army Special Operations Command, and he received it, and was the senior representative at the memorial service, and that's where we held him accountable in our report, saying you should have informed the family because you reasonably suspected friendly fire. We interviewed General Abizade, and there's detail in the report, but he had a P4 message, but he was in theater, and it didn't catch up to him until after the memorial service.
And is everybody you speak to under oath?
All the ones that we speak to in the interview were under oath, yes.
So General Abizade was under oath?
He was under oath.
And did you talk to anybody in communications in the Pentagon to find out how high up people knew about this and knew about the when it went from friendly fire and when they found out that because I'm assuming that there were an awful lot of people involved in putting together this memorial service because they knew the high attention it was going to get. So I'm wondering if you talked to everybody involved in the memorial service and how high up it went as far as people knowing about the friendly fire and the Silver Star.
Maybe let me clarify one at a time. Let me clarify the notification. What happened is when the event occurred on April 22nd, the notification next to Ken went out as hostile fire, and I think that's on record. What occurred shortly thereafter, when within the next day or so, that when they determined that fratricide was suspected, the proper way to have handled that was to put a supplementary notification report in, which would have changed the notification from hostile fire to unknown pending outcome of the investigation. That simply was not done. Now, there was a very close whole group, as best we can tell, that really knew that there was a friendly fire was suspected. And when I'm talking in terms of the chain of command.
But at the memorial service, you stated that the senior officer that spoke had every indication that was not correct.
Absolutely, and
there was no one, no senior DOD Department of Defense person representing the Secretary's office. There was nobody higher up there that knew what was going on. Did you investigate to find out if they knew?
We went to the Secretary of Defense in writing and asked what he knew and when he knew, and we got a letter back from him dated December 15, 2006, and basically said that he was unaware until sometime in the May 20th time frame and that basically kind of ties in with when the 15-6.
So you didn't, when I asked you if everybody was under oath, you didn't speak directly.
We did that in a letter. He was not under oath. That part was in a letter.
How long did it take him to respond back to your letter? Because it usually takes me 6 to 9 months to get an answer back.
Well, he responded on about the day he left, so I think we'd actually put it over there about 2 weeks. I need to get back to you on the specific time when we went over and asked, but it was not 6 months. Because when we did the investigation, we came from the bottom up on it, as we interviewed. We started with the more junior people, and we interviewed up to we got the senior levels, and he was kind of the last person that filled in that gap for us.
Well, who's been held accountable for all these bad reports that you stated?
We referred those back to the United States Army. We identified the 9 people in the report, provided those back, and then they have that down under I guess the right term is inquiry. The commanding general of the training doctoration command, General Wallace, has been tasked with the acting secretary of the Army to assess all the facts based on the data that both we gathered and also what General Johnson's review gathered. And they're determining, we determine accountability. They're going to determine culpability if
You determined accountability.
Right. On page 59 of the report in our conclusions, we lay those out.
Well, it sounds to me from just gleaning through this report and all that it was pretty obvious that these reports weren't done right. Witnesses weren't spoken to, whatever. I would like to ask you about a news article, CBS Washington News. It appeared on April 20th, 2007. It talks about a specialist, Jade Lane, and he laid in a hospital bed in Afghanistan recovering from gunshot wounds inflicted by the same fellow ranger who shot at Tillman. Amid his shock and grief, Lane said he noticed guards were posted on him.
quote, "I thought it was strange," Lane recalled. Later, he said he learned of the reasons for their persistence. The news media were sniffing around, and Lane's superiors, and this is Lane's own words, quote, "did not want anyone talking to us." Did you talk to anybody about the security that was placed on people who were part of the unit that was fired on?
Did not.
You didn't?
No.
Well, sir, in my opinion, and I will take the time to read this from cover to cover, I have to say I wasn't impressed with the investigations that you reviewed. You weren't impressed with them, and I'm not impressed with yours. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. McCollum. Just before I recognize Mr. Sarbanes, I want to ask you this question. We start off our hearing about an email from the White House asking for information for the president to use at the White House correspondents' dinner. There's a P4 memo that you're familiar with. Do you know whether that memo ever went to the White House?
We think the P4 memo stopped with the three generals that were on it. It didn't go any further. We went and asked Secretary of Defense through the letter if he was aware of that information, and we got a negative response back. So it's my belief that based on what we've determined through sworn testimony, is that John Brown saw it before the memorial service. I was aware of it and did nothing with it. He wasn't in chain of command. Lieutenant General Kinzinger was aware of it, and he represented as a senior DOD official at the memorial service and chose not to share that information with the family. We held him accountable for that, and that's part of the referral.
Do you know if there was a response to the email sent from the White House?
I'm not aware of the that's kind of the public affairs chain of command, the message I see here was the question that do you have background on why Corporal Tillman joined the Army, and that wasn't really a part of what we were looking at.
So you didn't review the public affairs documents?
This one,
which would have said, shown that there wasn't, if there was an answer to the White House email.
I don't know that there was an answer to this specific thing. We were looking at the P4 message, and we know that
right.
From what we can,
I understand
tell,
what you said, but what I've asked you is the White House sent an email asking for information for the president to use in his speech, and I asked you whether you knew whether there was a response to that email.
We didn't look at that. It was in the Jones investigation, and we didn't see it as an open issue.
Still an open issue?
No, we said we did not see it as an open issue.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask, of course, is that 2 days later, after the email was sent, the president spoke of Pat Tillman at the correspondents' dinner, and he was very careful not to mention how he was killed. And, of course, the P4 memo said exactly that. Be careful to not talk about how Pat Tillman was killed. Mr. Sarbanes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gimbel, I'm trying, as Representative McCollum was a moment ago, to get my head around the investigations that occurred right after the incident and then from that point forward. And obviously, the death of this brave soldier was a tragedy, but the travesty is then what followed very quickly, which can only be viewed as a kind of impulse to cover up basically what had happened. And I was looking through your prepared testimony again, and you talk about you say that the errors in reporting within the chain of command bear ultimate responsibility whether the chain of command bears ultimate responsibility for the inaccuracies, misunderstandings, and perceptions of concealment that led to our review. After your review, do you think this is a situation where we're dealing with a perception of concealment or actual concealment?
Of course, if you're asking me my opinion, I think it was not a well-handled after the fact. The Army did not handle this very well. I think they recognize that. I don't see that it was a cover-up, because the investigation is what the failure was to share with the family. The investigations pretty much right off the start all concluded the same thing, that it was a friendly fire incident. Okay, there was some mistakes made on how they appointed the investigating officers. There was some less than a lot of the people that should have been interviewed were not interviewed. The rules and regulations for the protection of evidence were not followed. We point out all of those issues, all those deficiencies in those investigations, and we've referred that back to the Army to see if there's things that they think we're sitting there accountable. There's mistakes made. Now they will make the determination if there's any additional administrative or criminal punishments necessary. And I think you'd find our summary in the report that we have the statement that says we found no reasonable explanation for this failure to follow the regulations.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Would you yield to me, Mr.
Yes,
Sarbanes?
Absolutely.
I still want to pursue this question about this P4 memo. The P4 memo was sent to three generals, to Kenzinger, Abizaid, and Brown. Abizaid said he didn't get it till later. Kenzinger got it before the memorial service. And the memo is advising these generals to let the Secretary of State and others know, Secretary of Defense and others know, that there may be a problem if they refer to how Pat Tillman was killed. You asked the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Rumsfeld, whether he ever received that P4 memo, and you never asked him personally, but you asked him in writing, and he came back and said no. How is that believable, that three generals wouldn't send up the chain of command a memo like this?
Well, the addressees on the P4 were the three generals, and I can't explain why they chose not to move that up, other than General Kinzinger, as I understand, was wanting to not move forward with the notification until he had all the facts laid out as to whether it was friendly fire or not. There was still that investigation; those investigations were going on.
And you didn't pursue this further?
Well, what we did is we thought that he actually told us that he didn't know about it until after the ceremony himself, and that's one of the ones that we referred to the Army to look at.
Did you request any documents from Secretary Rumsfeld to verify this?
We have a letter back from him.
Just a letter?
A letter, correct.
Okay. Mr. Honda?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And following up on that, Mr. Gimbel, would you submit that letter as a matter of record, please?
We sure will.
A letter from Mr. Rumsfeld. To Mr. Johnson, thank you for saying that you would help Mr. Lacey with the FOI for one of his constituents. We have a parent here from North Dakota that has the same request. Would you accommodate her also?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I mean, we process them as fast as we can.
Thank you.
I just haven't seen those.
Okay. Mr. Gimbel, as you know, the Tillman family was not informed of the actual cause of Corporal Tillman's death until 5 weeks after the incident. One critical question here is when Central Command, Commander General Abi Said, learned that Corporal Tillman had died by friendly fire. On page 24 of your March 26, 07 review, review matters related to Corporal Tillman's death, you report that General Abi Said told us that there was a delay of 10 to 20 days in his receipt of the message from General McChrystal informing of Corporal Tillman's fratricide, because General Abi Said was in Iraq. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. According to recent Associated Press news reports, however, General Abi Said visited Afghanistan within a week of the incident in question and may even have spoken to Corporal Tillman's platoon commander. If this is accurate, then I would find it highly unlikely that General Abi Said could have remained unaware of the cause of Corporal Tillman's death. According to the same AP report, however, your spokesman said that investigators did not look into General Abi Said's visit to Afghanistan. Mr. Gimbel, were you and or your investigators aware of General Abi Said's Afghanistan trip? And if so, I'm extremely perplexed why you would not have looked into this.
We were not aware of the Afghanistan trip on April 29th. I would only submit this, though, is if he talked to the lieutenant. The lieutenant is according to what we have in sworn testimony, was unaware that he was a victim of friendly fire for about 10 days after the incidents, which we put it into May. So I'll have to get back to you on the Abizaid trip.
Okay. This is a platoon commander that was unaware.
Well, he was injured. He was shot up pretty badly.
But the platoon commander was aware of it.
According to the documentation we have, he was not aware for 10 days that he was a recipient of friendly fire.
The platoon commander. That means he's the commander of the platoon within which this event occurred.
But it also means he got shot, pretty seriously shot.
Not every one of those soldiers who were involved knew.
According to the sworn testimony we have, the lieutenant didn't know for 10 days. He was under the impression that he was a result of hostile fire.
So there was active insulation of information from the platoon commander. Is that what you're telling me?
I'm telling you he was in the hospital, is my understanding. He was very seriously injured.
The platoon commander?
Right.
Okay. Yet, by April 29th, he was able to be visited by the general.
I'm not aware of that visit, but I don't dispute it.
Okay. The issue about Captain Richard Scott, former commander of headquarters and headquarters company, 2nd Ranger Battalion, conducted initial inquiry into the events in question, a report that you had discounted. Is that correct?
What the initial investigation, the battalion commander, or the regimental commander, I'm sorry, determined that it was not sufficient, so they never issued a final report on it. They took the draft work in that. And
did you know the contents and the conclusions of that draft report?
They've reconstructed it. They didn't get a copy of the report because I guess it was destroyed, but they've reconstructed the findings.
Did you know the conclusion of that draft report?
Yes, it was friendly fire.
Okay. Captain Scott's investigation included taking sworn statements from witnesses nearly immediately after Corporal Tillman's death. In other words, when eyewitnesses' memories were the freshest, regardless of any potential lackings, clearly Captain Scott's report was invaluable. On page 17 of your March 26th review of matters related to Corporal Tillman's death, you note that Captain Scott said that his investigation concluded that there was gross negligence and that he recommended the headquarters further investigate to determine whether there was criminal intent. However, on the same page of your report, you determined that Captain Scott's findings disclosed no mention of gross negligence and no recommendation for further investigation to determine criminal intent. How, Mr. Inspector General, were you able to conclude this since, according to page 14 of your March 26th review, you note that, and I quote, after a wide-ranging effort to include data calls, computer searches and witness interviews, we were unable to locate an intact copy of CPT, name redacted draft report. How were you able to conclude that?
I think if you go ahead and read on, it'll conclude that we were able to gather the data and the conclusions, pretty much. So we didn't have the exact report, but we had, based on some documentation that we gathered, and we can obviously provide that.
Mr. Gimble, we were talking about the missing documents from Captain Scott and your conclusions. So let me ask you, if you had not had access to Captain Scott's report in its entirety, and even if you were able to piece together portions of it, how were you able to determine that he did not conclude that there was gross negligence and recommend that HQ further investigate potential criminal intent?
In his findings and recommendations, we didn't see where he concluded. He didn't comment on that in those. So that was the point. We have his findings and conclusions, and we didn't see where he used those words of gross negligence. That's how we concluded.
Okay. To Mr. Johnson, General Johnson, at least seven times the Army Criminal Investigation Command report addresses the possibility of a Predator unmanned aerial vehicle, or UAV, having overflown the battle zone. In one of these instances, on page 571, Your report notes that Jonah Boykin made a formal request for any Predator footage and that he, Jonah Boykin, would follow up with CIA to ensure that a review for the requested imagery be conducted. There's no further mention made in the CID report as to whether there was, in fact, follow-up with CIA. General, did you look into whether this occurred? If so, what were the results of your inquiry, and why were they not included in the CID report? If you did not look into this, why not?
Yes, sir, we did look into that. We had one soldier in the trail vehicle who was the close air support coordinator, and he is the one who mentioned that he believed there was a Predator in the air during the incident because he recognized the sound of a Predator. Based on that, we followed up on that, tried to go through our local channels, did not come up with any, then submitted that actual request to the Deputy Undersecretary of Intel, General Boykin, in September. Got back from him that he had went through the special ops channels and had went through the CIA channels, and there was no Predator records of that particular point on the battlefield. So at this present time, we do not believe there are any.
Would there be records that would validate that conclusion?
We have our reply back from General Boykin, yes, sir.
Can you submit that as a matter of record?
Yes, sir, we can.
But in your opinion, would there be other ways of verifying that conclusion, that there were not any Predators in that area?
Sir, I don't know what other channels we would go through. He would have access, and he went to the CIA and the special ops who controlled the Predators.
Would they not share that information? Would there be a reason why they would not share that information?
Sir, the answer we got back was there was no Predator reports.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Honda. I just want to ask a few wrap-up questions, if I might. Lieutenant Colonel Robinson, you were interviewed about this videotape by the Washington Post of Jessica Lynch, and your statement, according to the Post, was, quote, "We let them know if possible we wanted to..."
that we would have requested as soon as we found out that there was a potential rescue.
Okay. Mr. Gimbel, I was shocked to hear press reports that Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarik made comments to the media saying that the Tillmans cannot come to terms with their loss because they are not Christians. Did you examine these comments as part of your investigation? And are there any military rules or procedures that address Army officers who make denigrating comments about deceased servicemen and women and their families?
We did not investigate those comments. I saw the comments in the paper, and frankly, I was shocked by them too, but we didn't investigate. I would defer to my military brothers as to if there are procedures or things that you can and can't do in that regard.
Does anybody here know whether there was a violation of any military regulation for a general to make these disparaging comments about service people, deceased service people or their family?
Sir, I don't know of any regulation prohibiting that, but I find it totally unacceptable.
Is there anything such as a conduct unbecoming a member of the United States Armed Services?
There is such a charge as conduct unbecoming an officer, yes, sir.
Yeah, well, that sounds like it's a pretty unbecoming statement for an officer to have made. Our hearing today has been about two cases, the Tillman case and the Lynch case. And in both cases, it seems like we say deceptive, misleading information. It wasn't misleading information. We have false information that was put out to the American people, stories that were fabricated and made up. In the case of Specialist O'Neill, his statement was doctored. It was actually rewritten by somebody. These aren't things that are done by mistake. There had to be a conscious intent to put a story out and keep with that story and eliminate evidence to the contrary and distort the record. In the case of Jessica Lynch, we have the Washington Post story saying that they were told by government officials. So it was attributed in the Post to government officials. And what we have is a a very clear of deliberate abuse intentionally done, why is it so hard to find out who did it? Why is it so hard to find out who's responsible and to hold them accountable, Mr. Gimbel?
We believe that we did find out who's accountable. It's going to be up to the Army to determine what to do with it, and we've referred that, and I think General Wallace will be finishing his initiative here in the near term, and I think there'll be a lot of final answers to some of these questions.
General, Brigadier General Johnson, do you have any comment on that?
Sir, I think it's essential that we do determine the truth and who is responsible, and as Mr. Gimbel said, that is exactly what General Wallace has been tasked to do and make recommendations to the Sec Army.
Okay. And do you know whether he's going to go all the way up the chain of command, find out how far this goes?
Sir, that's his investigation.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to his report that he'll be producing as a result of his investigation. I thank all of you for your presence here today. It's been very helpful to us to understand this situation better. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
That concludes our business, and the committee hearing is adjourned.
You've been listening to excerpts of the April 24th Congressional Oversight Hearing on the Accuracy of Battlefield Information. This audio is courtesy of C-SPAN, and you can view the entire four-hour proceedings online at the archives at c-span.org. Towards the end, you heard Representative Honda of the Tillman's hometown of San Jose, California, question Army criminal investigator Brigadier General Rooney Johnson regarding the presence of a Predator reconnaissance drone. Johnson's information conduit was the fanatic General Boykin I referred to in my introduction to the program. Just a final word about Boykin that goes to his credibility. Seymour Hersh wrote in his New Yorker series exposing the torture at Abu Ghraib that a unit headed by Boykin and Stephen Cambone brought, quote, unconventional methods to Abu Ghraib as a way of getting better information about Iraqi insurgents. So Boykin was directly implicated in the scandal that it seems the phony story of Tillman's death was created to distract attention from. And Boykin is not just any Christian fundamentalist torture master. He's long been a part of the Christian Dominionist movement, which actively seeks to create a Christian theocracy in the U.S. Boykin's religious speeches in uniform that drew so much criticism were part of a cross-country tour of fundamentalist churches. Watchers of the Christian fascist movement believe it was a recruiting tour to gain more Christian soldiers for the military. The U.S. military is becoming increasingly populated with Christian dominionists at all levels. I wonder how many of them were on the battlefield the day Pat Tillman died, or in the chain of command that dealt with a cover-up. Sadly, these are questions I don't expect Congress will ask, but somebody needs to. You can download an MP3 of this and all our programs at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by